This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hi, this is Brooke. Welcome to our midweek podcast. True crime represents an unbelievably popular genre in, well, any medium. Books, movies, TV shows, podcasts, they all pull in the audiences by playing to our deepest fears, our most sensational imaginings. The genre also exploits our misconceptions and biases about crime, and some argue can even make them worse. But at its best, true crime can make us an offer we can't refuse, the chance to try and understand a master criminal mind. Rachel Corbett stumbled upon that phenomenon while working on an upcoming book about criminal profiling. The former FBI agents she called up kept talking about these podcasts they were listening to, where the mobsters of a bygone era speak for themselves. Corbett is the author of a recent article in The New Yorker called Why the FBI Loves Mob Podcasts. And as it turns out, they are having quite a moment.
So they've all started in the last few years. Sammy the Bull is one of the fan favorites.
That's Salvatore Gravano, the Gambino family underboss in the late 80s, who you wrote was involved in at least 19 murders during his tenure as John Gotti's enforcer.
Exactly. He was the underboss, which means he was second in line if anything should have happened to Gotti. And he was a hitman, rose his way through the ranks. And he was involved in 19 murders, meaning he either executed them personally or he directed them. And now he tells the tales of these crimes and many others from the Phoenix suburbs where he lives to be near his grandkids.
You wrote he spent 17 and a half years at a supermax prison, but he's not still there. So he turned on Gotti, right?
Exactly. He flipped on Gotti. Gotti got caught implicating Gravano in a series of murders. And Sammy was angry that he wasn't the one who got pinched. Gotti did, but Gotti wanted him to do the time. So he flipped and went to the FBI and got Gotti put in prison for the rest of his life.
I wonder why he wasn't afraid to be murdered. Is it because he was with Gotti so long he knew exactly how and when it could come?
There was a hit out for him. I mean, there have been several hits out for him, I believe, since he ratted on Gotti. So it's not like he went scot-free, but he was in witness protection for a while. So he was safe then. And now I think he feels relatively safe because the guys he was running with at the time are now in their 70s and they're retired. It's really the Russian mob now, apparently, that's taking over. So I think they're all grandfathers or they're gone themselves.
And so what's his show like?
He tells war stories, basically. He's got this very slow voice and he's, like I said, in his 70s.
When I think back about my past, I feel like I have lived three lifetimes. I grew up in Bensonhurst, Brooklyn. I had loving parents, a great family. I was a happy kid.
He recounts his greatest hits, basically, when he ordered the execution of mob boss Paul Castellano, which was at the time, a huge, colossal undertaking. No one killed one of their own bosses.
Right. He was Gotti's predecessor.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And then he tells this case of the DEA agent that was killed by a mafia associate, which was one of the biggest cases in FBI history, one of the biggest manhunts in FBI history. He just goes through basically all the crimes he's involved with and is very happy to lay them out play by play. Sometimes cases that he wasn't involved with, but his associates were. And he just tells it in this very slow, very cinematic way. And it's kind of like watching a gangster movie. He's the real deal. He sounds like a gangster. He talks like a gangster. He still is one, of course.
but different stylistically is Jimmy Calandra, who was an enforcer for the Bonanno family, which you say is reportedly the most brutal of the five families who control organized crime in New York. His style in his YouTube series is very different.
Yeah, his is a lot of airing of old grievances and score settlings and gripes about people. There's a lot of technical difficulties he's having with using YouTube, which is pretty funny. And he's always asking his subscribers to help him out with technical difficulties. But usually it's, you know, a lot of scumbags and losers. And
that's his language, is what you're saying. Or are those his guests?
Well, that's his language. That's who he's talking about.
You ain't no gentleman. I could tell you that. You're no gentleman. Nobody likes you. You got these kids. You got Hootie and the other drug addict attacking me. And if they did it to my face, they get drop kicked in the jaw. I tell you straight out.
He does a YouTube show, so you can see him. And he's often in a basement somewhere. He still wears the Adidas tracksuit.
Sounds more like Wayne's World than, you know, Goodfellas.
Yeah, it's not very high tech.
And yet another style is one you mentioned, an interview show called The Sit Down with Michael Francis.
It's an interview show. He usually talks to actors who've been in various mobster movies.
And this is the second edition of Mob Movie Monday. As you know, we're alternating Mondays between Mob Movie Monday and Mob Story Monday. Today it's Mob Movie Monday. And today we're going to review Donnie Brasco.
I think he had the real Donnie Brasco on his show actually once. And he gives tips, you know, mafia lifestyle tips, how to, you know, how to live your best life if you want to join the mob, and business tips. He gives investment tips sometimes. He's a motivational speaker, so he gives kind of general, you know, how to be a better leader kind of tips.
What qualifies him to do this? Does he live in a van down by the river?
I think he's made a lot of money, and he's living in Orange County, having a pretty good life, actually. He's the son of Sonny Francis, who is a very famous mobster, and he was a former capo for the Colombo family. So he was pretty high ranking. He was more of a racketeer. Sammy would say he was a gangster. Michael Francis was a racketeer. So he was a big earner for the family.
Does every one of the five families have a representative in the podcast or media world?
Well, the ones I talked to were two guys from the Gambino. There's a Colombo. I didn't speak to anyone in the Lucchese or the Genovese families, but, you know, I would bet you there are.
Mm-hmm.
I spoke to maybe four of these guys, and that's just the tip of the iceberg.
You mentioned a famous case of the murder of a drug enforcement agency, undercover agent, that Sammy the Bull discussed, which was of tremendous interest to an FBI agent that you spent some time with for this story. His name is Fitzgerald.
Yeah, so he worked this case. This case was a huge deal because there was a sort of unspoken rule that the mafia didn't kill members of the FBI and the FBI didn't kill members of the mafia. Well, they didn't kill any federal agent. And so when this happened, it unleashed the biggest manhunt in New York history at the time. The feds just cracked down on every aspect of the mafia, their gambling rings, their clubs, and they just really put on all the pressure to try to find this guy who killed one of their own. This just wasn't supposed to happen.
You mean they went into places and said, "Nice club you got here. It'd be a shame if something happened to it."
I think more or less, yeah.
And Sammy the Bull said, you know, it made sense because this number one rule was broken. But then the mobsters and the FBI found themselves in a weird position over the death of this guy, competing to figure out who'd get him first.
Yeah, the mafia was really angry that this guy, who he wasn't a made guy, he was a low-level drug dealer. He's the one who killed the agent, and they were angry because now suddenly all their clubs were raided. The feds were breathing down their back, and so they wanted to catch this guy too and just get rid of him. That way the FBI would leave him alone, they hoped. So they were both hunting the guy. The FBI wanted to catch him in order to flip him, put him in jail, maybe get some more information out of him. The mafia didn't want that either, so they just wanted to kill him. And in the end, they're the ones who found him first.
Fitzgerald was very interested in this story, as Gravano told it, because there were so many unanswered questions.
Yeah, he personally worked this case. And of course, it was solved. They knew who killed the undercover agent. but they didn't know anything about him. They didn't know the circumstances. So it kind of fizzled. They didn't really get all of the details they were seeking. There were other murders associated with this case as well. You know, associates that died along the way that the murderer, Gus Faraci was his name, was staying with. The mafia killed that guy. So all these questions about the circumstances were unanswered, and Gravano really goes through those in his podcast.
So did that give Fitzgerald closure?
Well, he certainly found it interesting. He was able to find out how they think when this is going on. He was surprised to hear, for example, that Sammy the Bull thought the FBI wanted them to murder him.
Yeah, it had a certain Beckett quality. Will no one rid us of this meddlesome murderer?
Exactly. Of course, they didn't want him to die. They wanted information. But, you know, the mob operates how the mob operates. And so it's not that he really found out material details, some of them knew they can prosecute, but it was a lot of color and context and understanding that they gather from just hearing it from the other side of the issue.
My wife answered the door, and she said, Sammy, there's FBI by the door. I went to the door, and I says, what can I do for you? He says, Sammy, we want you to tell John Gotti that we want this guy found, and we don't care how. The way they said it, I just had to ask the question. Are you asking me to kill him? Oh, no, Sammy. No, you know, we're not going there. But we don't give a fuck how he's found.
They close cases, but they live on in their minds. And I think that the curiosities go on, even if it's in the past and the books are closed.
Does Fitzgerald have a podcast?
He does.
Yeah? What do you think of it?
It's great. I mean, it's a different tone for sure, but he also goes through the biggest cases of his career. He's one of the agents who was on the Unabomber Task Force. Mm. He did the linguistic analysis. So he talks about, you know, huge cases that he's worked, and you get a lot of insight into those as well.
So he's a profiler.
Exactly.
You mentioned that these mafia guys have different styles, but is there more of an emphasis on graphic storytelling or of romanticizing the days of the wise guys and the mafia code?
I think it's very much both. They would tell you they're not romanticizing the wise guy spirit, but it's hard for me to see how they're not in a way. It's telling stories about all the money they had and the women they had and all the lifestyle and, of course, the gruesome violence, too. One of the guys I talked to, John Alight, says specifically to me that he does not want to glamorize the lifestyle. In fact, his whole purpose is to teach kids not to join gangs and to stay away from a life of crime.
John Alight was also a hitman for Gotti.
Exactly. Yeah, kind mm-hmm. of the next generation after Sammy the Bull. But at the same time, you know, he sells signed baseball bats on his website because he was very notorious for using the baseball bat in his jobs.
Of all of the performers you've encountered, who's your favorite?
I have to say Sammy the Bull, just because there's something very charming about his style. He's got this just slow voice. It's kind of soothing in a way. And he's, you know, he sounds like he could be in a movie. He's really transports you. You know, if you like mobster movies, which I happen to, it feels like you're watching one. Of course, it's the real thing. I mean, you know, and I guess that's maybe why these guys have been so successful, because they are often charming. You know, one of the agents told me he had to always remind himself when he's hanging out with them in the club that they would not hesitate to kill him in another situation. Mm-hmm. They're smiling and laughing and they actually like each other, but there's another side, of course.
It's just business.
Exactly. That's what the podcasts are, too. I think they found another way to earn on the other side.
How does the FBI segment of the Mafia podcast demographic listen differently from just a regular person? Are they trying to decode these things?
I think so. They're not just listening for a wild ride of a story. They already know the story. I think they're listening for details that they didn't know. One agent told me that he was really interested in the psychology of the Mafia. Mm-hmm. These guys are known for not speaking, of course. They take a code of silence. So it was always very hard to get them to talk, and now suddenly they're opening up about everything, in some cases about how they feel and what they were thinking at the time and what motivated them. And then the other agent told me he was really kind of listening for clues about old cases, just to shade in what actually happened, put pieces together.
Is he the guy who also listens for what's being left out?
Yeah, Fitzgerald said that, because in that Sammy the Bull episode about the DEA agent, he doesn't mention a murder that happened. One of the men who was housing Gus Faraci, who killed the agent, was also killed. And Fitzgerald thinks that Sammy very likely knew who did it, if not wasn't involved in it himself, because they can talk about anything that they confess to. They have legal immunity to any crimes that they confess to. But if they didn't confess to a crime, then, of course, they really shouldn't be talking about it. So if they're not talking about something on their show, you know, one might infer that maybe that's something they were involved in.
You know, part of the beauty of podcasting is it's an open medium. Anyone can give their side of the story. How much trust do you think one should put into the words of even retired mafia bosses?
You should probably be skeptical. I think that's safe to say. I think there's a lot of aggrandizing that goes on of oneself and one's legacy as they look back. And, you know, they watch mobster movies too. And I think that, you know, everyone wants to live up to a certain image and, you know, retell the story the way they want to. And who's going to know the truth, you know?
Are you a true crime fan yourself?
I am. I'm writing a book about criminal profiling right now, so I confess I consume a lot of this medium myself. It's probably rot for your brain.
All right, so we'll call you when we do our full hour on true crime podcasts, but thank you very much for this.
Oh, please do. Thank you so much.
Rachel Corbett is deputy editor at ArtNet News, author of You Must Change Your Life, about the poet Rilke and the sculptor Rodin. And she penned the recent New Yorker article, Why the FBI Loves Mob Podcasts. Thanks for listening to the Midweek Podcast. You can check out the big show on Friday. It's going to be interesting and new. And always check out our newsletter. It's always really cool. Bye.